From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue our analysis of the results of last week's presidential election with Dr. Gerald Horn, history professor who holds a chair at the University of Houston and the author of dozens of books on American history. Dr. Horn, what a ride.
This election is an earthquake. The headline is "The Crisis of Whiteness and White Supremacy is Now the Crisis of the Planet." Tellingly and strikingly, it's the New York Times in a story just a few days ago that carried the headline "Crisis of Whiteness," a term and a phrase, by the way, that is conspicuously not used by many of our friends on the left, captured in some senses what's at stake in this election. That is to say, the electorate, that is to say 60% minimally of the Euro-American population, voted race. They voted for a revolt against the changes that have taken place in the country and in the world over the last six decades. That includes the retreat from white supremacy and Jim Crow. That includes the rise of feminism. That includes the erosion of race privilege and male privilege. That includes also, I should add, the rise of China. And there hangs a tale, because sadly and unfortunately, the New York Times in their article on the crisis of whiteness did not mention the role of China in helping to bring this about. Ordinarily and customarily, that would be the role of the left. But the left has basically abandoned its battle stations with regard to questions of white identity politics. When the term identity politics comes up on the left, traditionally it's imposed and refers to people such as myself, that is to say, a black person. But it's taken the mainstream press, strikingly enough, to suggest what we should have already known, that white identity politics is the original form of identity politics. That's the identity politics that led to the formation of the United States of America in 1776. And by the way, after the financial crisis of 2008, many economists were made to walk the plank because they did not predict this cataclysm. They did not see it coming. I think likewise, many of our pundits and pollsters need to walk the plank, but also many of our scholars and historians, because they have created a myth that the United States was created in 1776, not as the first apartheid state, but as this flexible state that had principles embedded in this so-called Holy Constitution that were sufficiently flexible to apply to us all, including a black person like myself whose ancestors were enslaved. The electorate delivered a message yesterday which says that that particular point of view is invalid. There is also an explanation that is due us from certain of our feminist friends, by the way. What I mean is, we oftentimes hear about the gender gap, but if you take away the fact, the point, that 90% plus of black women usually vote against the right, what you're left with is what you saw yesterday, which is that over 50% of white women voted for an admitted and confessed sexual predator. Like their white male counterparts, they too voted race. And we need an explanation from that community for this crisis that's going to worsen conditions for us all. Not least the fact that the Paris Climate Change Agreement is now up for grabs. Also, the international situation will become ever more complicated. I dare say that I expect Mexico to join an alliance with China. Those two countries were the major foreign targets, other than Muslims, of course, of Mr. Trump's ire. You may know that certain left-wing legislators in Mexico City before the election said that if Trump wins, they want to reopen the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which after the United States seized a significant percentage of Mexican territory in the war from 1846 to 1848, guaranteed supposedly equality and rights for people of Mexican origin found on this side of the border. Obviously, the United States, as it has so often done, has not kept up its end of the bargain. And I support the effort to reopen the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, just like I support the effort of Mexico to protect its sovereignty and its independence by engaging in an alliance with China. Speaking of which, we were faced in this election with a choice of whether or not we were going to vote for a candidate, Hillary Clinton, who said confront Russia first, or vote for a candidate, Donald J. Trump, who said confront China first. The electorate, in its alleged wisdom, voted for the latter. But if you strip these issues bare, you have to come to the conclusion, sadly and tragically, that from the point of view of the U.S. ruling class, Trump's confront China strategy made more sense. What I mean is that obviously the United States should be working with Russia, as Trump suggested, to squash religious zealotry. Instead, what we had from Senator Clinton was the resuscitation of some of the worst excesses of the Red Scare, the kind of Moscow bashing that I thought had gone out of fashion in the 1950s. And sadly and tragically, many of her left-wing supporters, who really should have known better, instead of reprimanding and reproving her, instead of taking a position perhaps of critical support, that is to say, I support Senator Clinton, but I don't support this Moscow bashing because it doesn't make any sense, and it's inimical to the interests of the U.S. progressive movement, they were mostly quiet. And they need to be criticized, and they need to engage in self-criticism. All in all, this election has been a disaster, not least for the white working class voters who cast their ballot for Mr. Trump, because they will be suffering too. But it's particularly going to present a stiff and major challenge to the planet itself, and particularly the people of color, because this electorate sent a message that they reject the changes over the last few decades that have seen a tentative and halting march towards equality. They want a counter-revolution, and counter-revolution, by the way, is the central impulse of the United States, as I suggested in my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. And once again, and to reiterate, the scholars and the pundits and the pollsters need to engage in a major self-criticism.
So let's parse some of that. Let's look at, for example, the issue of feminists and the way they voted race instead of gender or class. Angela Davis wrote about that 35 years ago in Women, Race, and Class, as you know, and parsed an awful lot of that. Maybe we could revisit some of that.
Well, I mean, look, the problem is the way the country was founded. The problem is the country was founded not as some sort of liberal utopia, but founded as a slave owner's republic based upon racial privilege, that is to say white supremacy, and based upon male privilege, that is to say male supremacy. And it has been an uphill climb to reverse those evils. What has happened to help to reverse those evils was that in the 19th century, Haitian revolutionaries, as I suggested in my book, Confronting Black Jacobins, helped to ignite a general crisis of the slave system, and that crisis can only be resolved with that system's collapse, which it did first in the British Empire in the 1830s and then in the United States in the 1860s. But, of course, the empire struck back, and the United States sought not unsuccessfully to destabilize Haiti, up to and including splitting the island, leading to the formation of the Dominican Republic in 1844. Then, after slavery, you had the rise of Jim Crow and legalized apartheid. It took the rise of a class project, that is to say, thriving trade unions and a socialist camp and a national liberation movement that led to the retreat of that system of ossified racism, that is to say Jim Crow, with the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 in the United States, as the State Department brief in that case suggested, found it difficult to execute U.S. foreign policy as African and Latin American and Caribbean nations and Asian nations were coming to independence as long as people of African descent and Caribbean descent and Latin American Asian descent were treated like third-class citizens, Jim Crow had to go. But as in the 19th century, the United States was able to successfully destabilize socialist camp, national liberation movements, and of course, trade unions of the left as well. Exhibit A in that regard would be the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union under the leader of the Australian-American leader, Harry Bridges, headquartered in San Francisco, the most progressive union that this country has probably seen up until this point. There were unsuccessful attempts to deport him on the grounds that he was supposedly a communist. And of course, the Red Scare swept through the trade union movement, weakening the trade union movement, and of course, helping to make the white working class more susceptible to the right-wing populism that expressed itself on Tuesday, November 8th. So this is the problem that we're faced with as we speak.
And you know, this the rise of Trump as a candidate, of his candidacy, is lifting in the polls, in the primaries, and yesterday. It's part of a phenomenon that's broader. You had working class people that disaffected, you know, marginalized, and even becoming a precariat under Sanders as well. And you have people in the streets, and you know, in ways we haven't seen perhaps in at least a decade, maybe decades. The galvanizing issue across those sectors is the economic factors that people have suffered. The working class in general, white, black, brown, everyone has been getting their behinds kicked for a good 30, 40 years, and it's at a crisis even for the most privileged of them at this point. What are the prospects for building unity, and is it possible to do anything absent that unity?
Well, the second question is easier to answer, which it would be exceedingly difficult to have a successful pushback against Trumpism absent any kind of working class unity, which, by the way, brings me to my previous point, which is that now we have Rich Trumka, a former leader of the United Mine Workers, who is the head of the AFL-CIO. It's apparent with the vote in West Virginia, coal country, that went for Trump, that Rich Trumka cannot deliver his constituency. Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat, is rumored to now be in the process of switching. He's the senator from West Virginia, switching to caucus with the Republicans so he can get a chairmanship. If you look at the reelection of Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader from Kentucky, he won coal country to get reelected. So Trumka cannot deliver his constituency. We probably need a change at the top of the labor movement. Many of the black leaders and certain organizations, after partial citizenship was granted post Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, went to sleep. I guess they thought that they had successfully ended the struggle against Jim Crow, or at least had scored a major victory over it. But what happened was that there was just a truce in the struggle against Jim Crow, a truce that, of course, began to crumble as you saw our allies abroad in the last national liberation movements and the socialist camp in particular began to crumble. But the way out for the black community in particular, and this would then help to buoy and bolster the progressive movement generally, is to reassemble those global alliances. I would look south of the border to Mexico, which will be seeking alliances here in this country, given the pressure that's going to be on this country. You know, of course, that there was a severe collapse in the Mexican peso last night, one of the most severe collapses of that currency since the so-called tequila crisis of 1995, which, of course, required a major bailout by the U.S. administration. Obviously, there needs to be some delegation sent to Beijing instead of this nonsensical senseless criticizing of China's role in Africa. There needs to be an honest recognition of the fact that that criticism mostly does not come from Africa itself. It comes mostly from North America, which makes Africans think that we're once again carrying water for Uncle Sam, which is a lunacy of the first order. It's the looniest idea since Looney Tunes. So I do think that there is a way out, but it's going to require new thinking. It's going to require self-criticism. And I'm afraid to say it's going to require some very significant personnel changes.
On that point, as a matter of fact, you know, one of the things that people are saying out in the blogosphere today is that the theft or the perceived theft of the nomination from Sanders by Clinton elected Trump, that Sanders would have done better against Clinton, against Trump, and would have probably beat him. We are looking at the conditions you describe, of course, say in Africa, in quite a different position than we were 8 years ago with the installation of AFRICOM by the Obama administration and organized by the Department of State under Hillary Clinton. It didn't exist 8 years ago except as an entity in Stuttgart, now locked into the militaries of 35 countries on the continent, leaving Trump with quite a weapon if he wants to proceed in the manner that you describe. Do you think that perhaps some of the blame for the loss yesterday of Hillary Clinton could be, you know, could rest on those policies and on the theft of the nomination?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'll try to go through all of your points, but if I neglect one or two, bring me back into focus. One, with regard to Hillary Rodham Clinton and her spouse, Bill Clinton, they effectuated a policy with their so-called crime bill that basically led to the locking up of a good deal of potential voters for Clinton. And when they were released, assuming that they had felonies, that meant that they could not vote. Now, you can either say, A, this was stupidity on the part of Clinton and Clinton, short-sightedness of the First Order, or you could say, once again, that they analyzed the correlation of forces. They see that there is very strict and severe Afrophobia and Negrophobia in the United States of America, and they felt that they could not defeat it. They felt that they should surrender to it in order perhaps to get some gain or concession on another front. Whatever the case, obviously that policy did not work. With regard to Mr. Obama, certainly, as he himself has suggested, the major and worst mistake of his administration was Libya. He says the aftermath of the 2011 invasion, I would say the 2011 invasion itself, it not only helped to ignite a certain kind of religious zealotry on the continent that Africa will be dealing with for some years to come, which in turn then helps to lead to the so-called AFRICOM phenomenon to put out the fire that he helped to start, but it also poisoned the well with Russia and China, which felt that they had been traduced. They did not know that they were signing on to regime change when they inked and signed on to that United Nations resolution of the spring of 2011, which they thought was protecting civilians and for humanitarian reasons, but it led to regime change. It weakened the African Union because Jacob Zuma of South Africa, the continent's perhaps strongest economy, even if you look at Nigeria, he acquiesced as well, and the ANC acquiesced to it. So it was a major disaster, no question about it. With regard to Sanders, that's a counterfactual. I'm willing to accept that he would have done better than Clinton, but it's all speculation, it's all hypothetical. Right. And in any case, what we're faced with now is a major planetary challenge.
And on the question of war with Russia, for example, do you put any stock in Trump's approach to dealing with it? And do you think it's possible that the approach to China, rather than being military confrontation on the on the high seas off China's coast, might take place in the boardroom?
What do you mean by that?
That renegotiation of treaties and trade relations as opposed to military adventure, which, you know, we're looking at now in essence.
Well, that's possible. The problem is that we're at a hair trigger situation and things could easily spin out of control. He had a lot of inflammatory rhetoric during this campaign. People take that seriously, even if the people who voted for him did not apparently take it very seriously. With regard to Russia, I can only compare this policy with his policy of his number two challenger, speaking of Hillary Rodham Clinton, and to repeat, at least on paper, his policy towards Russia makes more sense than the policy of Senator Clinton of no-fly zones and so-called safe zones in Syria, challenging the Russian Air Force in a situation, once again, that's on a hair-trigger basis that could easily lead to miscalculation in a wider conflict. Commentators other than myself said that this could be a predicate to World War III, which could really ruin your day.
You think? Yeah. I know a discussion of policy among wisps of radioactive vapor isn't likely to be very productive. Okay, so here we are. We have President-elect Trump and, you know, a fight on our hands. We were going to have a fight on our hands no matter what. This particular fight has its own characteristics and, of course, will require its own strategy and tactics. What do you propose looking out from today going forward should be the course of action people follow?
Well, action and analysis. With regard to action, once again, I would like to reiterate that our organizations and perhaps even our radio commentators need to be reaching across the southern border. Mexico is going to be looking for allies. There is going to be an early attack on Mexican immigrants on these shores. Mexican Americans are going to be looking for allies as well. We all need to be linking arms and linking hands. Point number one. Point number two, once again, we really need a serious analysis and self-criticism of how we got to this point. I mean, for example, look at China. One of the most important episodes of this entire campaign took place a few weeks ago in Los Angeles, at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, where China's richest man, the head of the Wanda Group, which owns AMC theaters, which are scattered throughout this country, he just bought a stake in Sony Pictures. He wants to buy Paramount Pictures. And he laid down the law to Hollywood titans who came to kiss his ring. He basically said, we need more Chinese themes in Hollywood movies. We need more Asian actors, Chinese American actors. The way Hollywood is presently constituted has been an essential component of the ideological armor of white supremacy and U.S. imperialism. At this Hollywood meeting, the Chinese billionaire laid down the law. Did not go down very well. Read the New York Times episode, account of this episode. And this reflects what I'm talking about in terms not only of the general crisis of imperialism being challenged in this important sphere of profit-making and consciousness massaging that is Hollywood, but also a crisis of white supremacy. And so far as Hollywood has been a major vector of the implantation. If we're going to reverse that particular crisis, we're going to have to wade into the muck. Just like we send delegations to Mexico City, we're going to have to send delegations to China too.
Yeah. Okay. On that note, Dr. Horn, thank you for your time. A pleasure as always. And we'll be in touch with you again on this, I'm sure, because the struggle is only just beginning.
Thank you, sir.
Now that the election is behind us and the second term of President Barack Obama is coming to a close, with a new president, Donald Trump, coming into office, the question of whether or not our political prisoners could perhaps get pardoned before the end of the Obama administration has arisen. We bring you now a view of Trump's election from two victims of the American incarceration state. First, this commentary from political prisoner Mumia Abu Jamal.
Shock and awe. I didn't see this coming. The words I never thought I'd say, President Trump, have become reality. In a remarkable campaign full of bile, hatred, fear, and loathing, guess what? Fear won. Hatred now gulps a glass of champagne. This campaign has been marked by scenes we have never seen before, by words we've never heard said on TV or radio, by screams about a rigged system, folks. When a billionaire shouts about a rigged system, you better believe it, because it is, but in his favor, not against him. Donald Trump has received billions of dollars in free cable and media coverage, which lifted his campaign from farce into solidity. After every campaign stop, the strains of a song, "You can't always get what you want," was heard. It is now clear. You can't. Today, a new day dawns on America. As a curtain falls over the Obama presidency and Clintonism. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Kerry Shakabuna Marshall is being held at SCI Rockview Prison in Belafonte, Pennsylvania. Shakabuna has been incarcerated for over 25 years after being sentenced to life in prison when he was a juvenile. The activist work he does now, in collaboration with Prison Radio, centers on issues of youth incarceration and the effect it has on individuals, families, and communities. He offered this commentary on the election of Donald Trump for Prison Radio this past Friday.
Hillary Clinton and the DNC are to blame. It's official. After a stunning upset victory over Hillary Clinton, Donald J. Trump is now the president-elect of the United States of America. Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee, after losing the electoral vote 290 to 232 in the general elections, only have themselves to blame for their devastating loss for the grandest prize in the world, President of the United States of America. Unfortunately, the DNC chose to anoint Hillary Clinton as the Democratic presidential nominee before allowing the Democratic base to elect a candidate, and chose to undermine challenger Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries and co-opt his millennial movement supporters. The DNC even blew off a portion of the Democratic base, calling on Vice President Joseph Biden to seek the Democratic nomination over Hillary Clinton. In effect, the DNC robbed the Democratic base of their presidential nominee of choice, a choice that probably would not have been Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee. Hillary Clinton was a deeply problematic presidential candidate to begin with, who made fatal judgment calls throughout her presidential campaign. Hillary Clinton made the critical mistakes that caused her to suffer a humiliating defeat at the hands of Trump, such as failing to develop a message or catchy slogan to galvanize her Democratic base and capture the American people, selecting Timothy Kaine for vice president over Bernie Sanders, failing to truly acquire the millennial movement support that backed Bernie Sanders, and taking the black and Latino voting community for granted. Hillary and the DNC made the costly mistake of believing she was heir apparent of Barack Obama to the presidency and would receive the same voter turnout as President Obama did. But that was not to be. Voter turnout for Hillary was low among blacks, Latinos, and millennials compared to President Obama's elections in 2008 and 2012. Even white women voted 53% for Trump over Hillary. Perhaps Hillary Clinton simply was the wrong candidate at the wrong time. If there is anyone to blame for Hillary's presidential loss, Hillary Clinton and the DNC should only blame themselves for her dismal campaign performance and devastating loss at the election polls for the United States presidency. From the belly of the beast at Prison Radio, I am Shakabuna. Thank you for listening.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Over the course of this week, we will be hearing from a number of people attempting to dissect what happened last week and discuss what is coming. The list includes, of course, Professor Tony Montaro and Margaret Kimberly from BlackAgendaReport.com, as well as Danny Haifong from BlackAgendaReport.com, and retired naval officer and geopolitical strategist, lecturer at Moscow State University on International Affairs, Mark Sloboda. So make sure you tune in this week to the CPR News right here on your favorite community radio station, which you have to remember needs your support. If you like what you're hearing, remember them at pledge time. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.